Today is Tuesday, July 26th, 2022. This is part 5 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Gary Ladd. My name is Tom Martin. We are at our house in our kitchen sitting around the dining room table. Good morning, Gary. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Great. Gary, in part 4, we left off in 1975 or 6, you had an idea to boat from Height, Utah to Page, Arizona, to Waweep, except there's a reservoir there. There's no river. Can you tell me how you came up with that as a thing you wanted to do?
Yes, I can. We, in the first half of the 1970s, just had so many wonderful river trips, and I had my own dory, and I think I was kind of in love with that boat and the things it could do and the places we could go. So after the 1975 32-day Grand Canyon River trip, which was just a magnificent experience, I was trying to think of other things that were possible. And we had really great San Juan River trips too, but I was interested in knowing something about Glen Canyon. And Larry Testerman and I had seen a tiny part of the lake on a tour boat out of Waweep, just a two-hour tour, not a three-hour tour. It might be more famous. And went in, I think, to Navajo Canyon. It turned out, I later discovered, that boat was piloted that day by Harold Johnson, who years later I worked with on photo workshops on Lake Powell.
Oh, wow.
But I had pictures of the tour boat captain on that trip. But it was a really short trip, and I really wanted to know more about Glen Canyon, so I knew that Bert Loper had rowed up the river in Glen Canyon, and it just seemed reasonable to think about starting at the upper end and float from Height and row from Height down to Waweep. So I don't know how I picked out 19 days as the trip length, and I'm not sure I knew it would end up exactly at that length, but I must have known pretty well that it was going to take a long time because I wanted to go up the side canyons too.
Did you ask your friends if anyone else wanted to come along?
I don't think so.
Okay, so your intent was to do this solo. Bert did it solo, so.
Yeah, and I'm not sure there's a direct connection there.
Okay.
Later on, I did make more trips on the lake, either alone or with friends, and in one case, the Great Thumb, Larry's boat, also came along. And
okay.
So there were four people, I think, in two boats. And we started, in that case, at Waweep, rowed up to West Canyon, tied up the boat, and then went hiking on up West Canyon, did a backpack upstream to a place called Eber's Camp, and back. I'm not sure Eber's Camp was the ultimate destination of that trip, but I think we went at least that far and then back to the boats and then rode back to Waweep. I think that might have been in 78. Fred Verba was on that trip, and Fred was an astronomer at the Naval Observatory. Another connection between boating and astronomy. But the 19-day trip on Lake Powell was just magnificent, although a couple of things happened right at the beginning. A friend of mine who lived in Page, Devin Smith, a Park Service ranger, agreed to go with me. My old scout pulling the Tadahatsu on a trailer, he agreed to go with me up to Height and then bring my trailer and car back to Waweep, which I would eventually get. So Devin took off and I started rowing, and I didn't get very far that first day since most of the day had been consumed in driving. But that first evening was heartbreaking because I had gotten very used to being part of a group in those wooden boats, and we'd pull into camp and there'd be all this activity and people would be setting up tents and getting dinner ready, and I pulled in and nothing happened. There was no one around, it was totally silent, and it was very sad. So that first night didn't go all that well. Although, the other thing that happened that evening is that I used to carry a Sierra Club cup in my belt, as I had been taught by Martin and others. And I had a little piece of cord on it and a clip so that I wouldn't lose it, which I had done with earlier Sierra Club cups. So I'm sleeping, and I don't think I was using a tent. And I, in fact, I rarely used a tent up until 1983, when it was a very wet year, very wet spring. And of course, the big flood of 83 later occurred. But up until that time, I don't think I even owned a tent. I just, at most, would have a tarp that I'd crawl under. So I must have been sleeping out, and in the middle of the night, my cup started moving. I could hear it clinking against the rocks, and I turned on the flashlight, and a mouse had grabbed it by that cord and was making off with my Sierra Club cup.
I wonder how far it would have gotten.
Yeah, probably not too far, but it sure made a racket, so he didn't get very far. But that was just a great trip, and of course I had trouble with the wind. Sometimes I'd have to pull over and wait for a while.
So you launched off the concrete ramp at height?
Boy, I don't remember anything about what it looked like at the launching point, but I think, yeah,
okay.
I think probably, yeah.
And what maps did you have to help you navigate your journey?
I don't remember that either, but I have collected a lot of topographic maps, and I would guess, because I had been doing some other things around Glen Canyon, that I would have had topo maps, but also it's very likely that I would have had a copy of Stan Jones's map on Lake Powell that everybody had.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. By 1976, that map was out.
Yeah, and I think there were much earlier versions than the one I would have used.
Okay. Yeah. And, I mean, I would just assume that within minutes of launching, the fact that you were on still water instead of flowing water would have really hit home in that you have to work, you have to row to get that boat to anywhere. Did you have a transom with a motor, or were you rowing?
I was rowing. There was no motor, yeah. And the transom was too high for most motors, yeah. You know, I guess I had done some flat water rowing at the end of Grand Canyon on Lake Mead, so I knew what I was in for. But it was hard at first. You know, what I really remember more than that, the difficulty of rowing, was the darn boat wakes. Because unlike going down a river, where the waves are irregular and irregularly spaced, these boat wakes where it's just left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, they were a real pain in the neck. I much preferred having waves hit at irregular times, so I really remember that, but of course you get used to that too. And boaters seemed to be attracted to me, so they would come over to see what was going on with this guy rowing, this lone guy in an orange dory.
Would they actually, like, come off a plane, motor down, come over, offer a beer, say hello, what are you doing? Or would they just come close as they zipped right past you?
All of those.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I met some really interesting people on the lake, usually when I was camping. But most of the time, they would just come close by to get a better look for a second, and then they were gone.
Does he really not have a motor?
Yeah. Yeah, and it, you know, going down the river, going down the lake, it very strongly hit me that there's a sequence of thoughts, because as you know, there are a lot of side canyons that have pretty narrow entrances. So if you look down the main channel, you may see some boats going up or down the main channel, but you also see boats that just suddenly turn and go into a narrow side canyon that you may not have been totally aware was there, or you couldn't tell exactly where it was. So there were boats zipping in and out of side canyons. And it just occurred to me that, wow, it would be so much more efficient if there were some kind of transportation system in the canyon that would allow you to move from place to place and see these different locations. And then I thought, oh, well, there used to be such a transportation system, the river. So I don't know, that kind of struck me as a funny sequence of logic or illogic. Anyway, I had a good time, and I went into some really great side canyons, and one of the ones I really wanted to see was the Escalante, and I spent a fair amount of time in the Escalante. And one of the few times that I ever more or less saw a rock fall directly into the lake occurred in the Escalante. And I had just turned into a side canyon, so leaving the main Escalante, and perhaps it was Davis Gulch. And I heard a very large kaboom. And I looked up, and there was this tower of water sticking up out of the lake right at the base of the cliff opposite me. So it was 200 or 300 feet away, but it fell out of the ceiling of a shallow alcove.
And, wow.
But the Escalante was magnificent. I also wanted to see West Canyon, which we had backpacked into. Anasazi Canyon was another place that we had backpacked into, and I wanted to see that. Another thing that came up was once I was in a narrow canyon and there weren't any boaters around, it was awkward rowing with the oars sticking out so far on each side, and I constantly had to be turning around to see where I was headed because the canyons were narrow and twisting. But I realized that under the right conditions, I could hear walls coming. So I'm rowing along, I'm in a narrow canyon, it's very silent, and all of a sudden I awaken to the fact that I can hear the bow wake of the boat coming off of something. And I turn around, and there's a wall that's only 10 feet away or 5 feet away.
Oh, wow.
But that was very interesting to think that even that little wake at the front of a dory could be heard.
Yeah.
Of course, my hearing's not so good these days, so that probably wouldn't work as well. I would hit the wall. That's how I would detect it. But
did you bring a paddle to paddle? Because if you're limited by your oar lengths from the oar lock sticking out the sides of the boat, that's going to limit how far into these canyons you can go.
I don't remember taking a paddle. I do remember kind of shipping the oars more and more and trying to reduce the width that I was taking up. But once it gets so narrow, then you can just put the oars away or take them out of the oar locks and just start pushing against the walls to go back into a narrow canyon.
Okay. And were you able to actually get to where you could climb out of the boat and scramble up?
Yes, yeah, sometimes, not okay. always. Which, in one case, right after I had stopped at Bullfrog or Hall's Crossing Marinas, and I had made a phone call from there and perhaps purchased something, I had gone into a narrow slot canyon downstream from there. Could have been Annie's Canyon. And it got very narrow, and I was able to tie up the boat some way. Now, I've got chalks that I use today. I'm not sure I had those at that time, but I also know that I could, maybe I did have a paddle because I could, I don't remember, but I somehow tied up the boat in this narrow canyon and then got out of the boat and went swimming. So I'm swimming up this slot, and here it's pretty neat because there are boulders down below me that are caught between the walls, and then coming to a place, I think in that case, where I could not walk. I came to a boulder or a pour off that I couldn't get around. So I go dog paddling back to the boat. But this time, there's something in the water in front of me, and I think, oh, I must have knocked a piece of driftwood off that had been trapped under a boulder or something. And, of course, this thing is right at nose level as I'm swimming along, and I take a close look at it from about a foot. And it's dark and strange-looking, and then I realize it's my billfold that has come out of my pocket after having stopped at the marina. So, yeah, so
wow.
The billfold floats for a while.
Oh, thank heavens.
Yeah.
What month was this?
September, I believe, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So monsoon season, still a potential, but the big winds of the spring weren't a problem.
There were winds, but not spring winds, yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
It was, the timing was good. It was warm, but I could go swimming and cool off, and the summer crowds were at least partially gone.
Mm-hmm. Because the kids would have been back in school.
Yes.
And tourism would have started, been on the down run there. The distance from Hite to Wawi, following the center of the river, if you will, the Thalwag, trying to just put up a line on the map here, because the reservoir is really big, and you know, how would you do the distance? That distance is 200 some miles?
Following the old river channel, about 150.
Thank you, 150 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a 19-day trip.
Right.
So I'm working out the math. You're going maybe 10 miles a day if you're going to take a couple days off and do some hiking somewhere.
I never took any days off, I don't think.
Okay.
I really wanted to see as many side canyons as I could, so I visited a lot of them.
Hmm.
So I also did not like to be out in the middle of the lake where the traffic was greatest, so I would stay near the walls, and I would stay along one wall and then the other wall on the other side, depending upon which way the wind was blowing. If that made a difference, or if there was something over there that I was interested in. I actually kept a very careful track of exactly where I went on that trip. And that was because I had been on an earlier trip on the lake on a houseboat in 1980. That was with Wes Lockwood and some other Flagstaff people. And I had, oh, I know, I should have mentioned, I've forgotten this, a Dowler's Guide. So there was a couple from California by the name of Dowler, D-O-W-L-E-R. And apparently it was a couple or a family, and they had spent a lot of time on the lake and decided there needed to be a better map than what Stan Jones had provided. Now, Stan's maps were full of good information, but they did not show the lake accurately. The perimeter of the reservoir was just very generally drawn. But the Dowler's Guide was made of reproductions of topo maps.
Ah.
So it's kind of in a thin book, page after page, showing different sections of the lake. And I really got a lot of use out of those guides, and I ended up purchasing several of them because most of my trips, I think probably all of my early trips, I would show my route, which side of the reservoir I was on, how far up the side canyons I went, the time that I passed certain points, the time that I took hiking, and so I've got a record of that going back even to that first dory trip.
Nice. Okay. So you would row maybe 5 miles a day?
I think it was probably on average more than that. I mean, I would guess the total number of miles that I rowed was somewhere around 150, and I don't know if that means 125 or 200, but so 5, 6, 7, well, yeah, that's only 7 miles a day, so that seems a little low to me, but
okay.
Especially towards the end, because I really got stronger, and I got so I could row pretty darn hard for long periods of time.
Wow.
And I tended to do that towards the end of the trip.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think you could go maybe 2 miles an hour, 3 miles an hour?
I've kind of forgotten, but yeah, 2 to 3 miles an hour, that's probably okay. Right. Yeah.
So after 3 hours of rowing, you'd had your mileage in for the day and could take the rest of the day off to go hiking or exploring.
Yeah, and I think I'd have to look at that map again, but I made a lot of hikes. Now, some of them were very short, just to take a look at something, but yeah, it was great. Mm. I just thought it really was a great way to see the lake. And
nice.
And the boat, of course, not loaded with people and a lot of gear, was very light, so.
Unresponsive, easy to row.
Yeah.
Did you sleep on your boat, or did you sleep on the land?
On the land, yeah.
Okay. Were you drinking right out of the reservoir, or did you bring water?
I had water, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, the water quality on Lake Powell, if you're not in a side canyon where there's a lot of boaters, is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But I brought water, and I'm pretty sure I probably treated lake water with Clorox, too.
Okay. Which would be a simple treatment method. Yep. Easy to do. Water's fairly clear. You don't have to settle it or anything.
Right. Yeah.
So that was easy. And then did you bring, you mentioned shopping at Bullfrog or Hall's Crossing. Did you purchase some more food, or did you pretty much pack at the start of the trip to have food all the way?
I think I had food for the whole thing, but I don't remember what I bought, if anything, when I stopped at the marina. You know, I would have pulled out a credit card or something to make the phone call. So I don't remember purchasing anything, but I might have.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the ferry was in operation at that time?
I think maybe it's too early for the ferry, but I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
I did not have any interaction with the ferry, so I don't remember.
Okay. Did you have any historic photos of what Glen Canyon looked like before the dam at that time with you?
I had a library with me, and I also had a recorder so I could play some music as I went along.
Wow.
I would have had the place no one knew with me. I'm pretty sure that would have been with me, but I had a lot of books and maybe some others on the Glen Canyon area, but maybe not photo books.
Okay. The place no one knew is a Sierra Club produced book, mostly pictures of canyons, plants, and canyon walls. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I was about to say the photographer's name, and now it's gone.
It's not Ledet? Francois?
He was an author, but...
Okay, and it's not Tad Nichols, because Tad has another book on Glen Canyon. Mm-hmm. We're both spacing it here, so that's...
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know who I'm talking about, and I'll come up with it perhaps in a minute, but... Yeah.
But that book doesn't have a lot of photos of Rimrock looking down at the river.
Yes, it is mostly details, mostly in the side canyons, and they're very nice photographs.
Yes.
I like looking at them, but if I go through the book, which I do occasionally, at the end I just hit my head against the wall and said, oh, why didn't he show us more of the river corridor? I'd like to know what that stretch looked like. Now, Tad Nichols did take more of the river corridor.
Yes.
But nobody took enough.
Correct. Correct answer.
So, God, I'm really surprised I can't remember his name, but...
Porter?
Yeah, Elliot Porter, yeah. So, the library and the... recording machine, and so I could play music. And but in some cases, as I said, especially when I was camping, I camped near somebody else, and they would wonder what the hell this guy is doing, and they would say, why don't you join us for dinner? So that happened more
than once.
Oh,
that's nice.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I'm kind of confused on the timeline here. This is 76. Had you already done a houseboat trip on Lake Powell?
Not at that time.
Not at that time. So did anybody say, hey, come over to our houseboat and have dinner with us, and you got a chance to get a tour of their boat?
Yeah, you know, thinking about it now, that seems peculiar. I don't remember any cases where any houseboaters were very interested in me. It was speedboaters.
Okay.
Now, maybe that's just has some connection with being on your own big boat, and you don't want to mess with the smelly guy that just finished the day rowing.
So
I don't remember having any connection with any houseboaters at all on that trip.
Were you surprised to see houseboaters in remote locations of the lake?
No, not at all. They were, well, I'm tempted to say they were everywhere, but I really don't remember noticing houseboaters very much. And one thing that we've got to keep in mind here is that the houseboats at that time were much smaller than what we are used to today. These giant things that are out there now, 105 feet long and, you know, cost $5 million and have storage for jet skis on the back and two kitchens and washers and dryers and, you know, nicer than my house. Those didn't exist at that time.
Okay.
So Waweep was renting 50-foot houseboats. That's the biggest size they had.
Hmm.
They had no air conditioning. There were no private rooms. It was just bunk beds. And so it was a different world of houseboating in the 1970s. And that has gradually changed, although I think, to me, starting about 1995 is when it began to ramp up to the point where the houseboats out there, to me, are utterly ridiculous. They have granite countertops. I mean, what on earth are you doing floating granite around a lake and paying for the gas to do it? They're just absurd. But they were pretty primitive back in the 70s. I mean, I even had one person with me on a trip who looked... we were on a giant houseboat. They rented it, not me. We were on the upper deck, and we were looking at some other houseboats that were nearby. And one of them was one of these early-style Waweep 50-footers, which in the 1970s would have been the top houseboats that you could rent. And she looked at it and turned up her nose and said, "Well, you wouldn't catch me on one of those tin cans." So that's how much it had changed between maybe 1980 and 2010 or so. And
did anybody give you a tow, or did you row it all yourself?
No, no tows, nothing like that. The only towing experience I had was the following, or maybe 2 years later, Daryl Wilmarth, who I've probably mentioned, probably haven't mentioned, Daryl, and then Willmarth. He was a friend of mine that worked at Mount Hopkins before I ended up working there, and moved to Kitt Peak at about the time that I moved from Kitt Peak to Mount Hopkins. And he had his master's in astronomy and was helping to take care of the same camera I was involved in, the Krohn camera, when he was at Mount Hopkins. So I inherited the camera that he was using there when I moved to Mount Hopkins, but we ended up as friends, and we're still in contact today. Daryl and I did a trip on the lake where we started, I think on we did more than one trip, but I think this was where we started on the San Juan River, and at Paiute Farms.
Oh.
And rode to Waweep, the two of us.
I was going to say, Paiute Farms is the takeout for the San Juan.
Yeah.
What year was that?
I think it's 78. I'm pretty sure it's 78.
Okay. Well, let's hold that thought, because I want to know about that trip. What else do you recall about this September 1976 solo 19-day hike to Waweep?
I just, you know, I should have brought that map that would have reminded me of things that took place. But here's something that happened the moment the trip ended. I pulled up at the dock at Waweep and started walking up to where my car was parked, hopefully. And an older gentleman came up to me and said, "Hey, I saw you up near Rainbow Bridge. Is this the kind of boat that they use in Grand Canyon?" And I recognized this guy. It was Harvey Butcher. So
wow.
That was my first, I think, the first contact that I had with Harvey Butcher. Anyway, he had been out on the lake and had seen me, and then came up to me when he saw me on land at the end of my trip. And we talked for a little while, not too long, but it was fun running into him.
Nice. Well, that's fun.
But it was a great trip, and it led to other rowing trips, and some of them alone, where I would start and end at Waweep. Actually, there was some towing in one of those trips. I had some friends in Page who towed me upstream a long ways. And I've kind of forgotten exactly where they dropped me off, but it would have been somewhere in the vicinity of the turnoff to Rainbow Bridge.
Okay.
And then I rode back. But there were other trips that I started and ended at Waweep alone, and then the two-boat trip that I mentioned earlier, and then the two-person trip in the Tadahatso that started on the San Juan.
Gary, let's go back for a minute. I don't think we've talked about your time on Mount Hopkins.
That is still coming up.
It is. Mm-hmm. Okay. So at this point, you've left Kitt Peak.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And are you thinking about moving to Page, or are you still based out of Tucson?
Yes, still in Tucson, not thinking of moving to Page. I had for years thought that, I'm jumping ahead here when I say that, for years, as seen from a little later, I thought I would probably end up living in Flagstaff so I could be closer to Grand Canyon. And that didn't happen. But I skipped Flagstaff and went directly to Page.
Okay. But that's later.
That's later.
Okay. So at the end of this trip, I mean, you've seen historic height. It was underwater. You've seen a little bit of the Horn. A lot of it was underwater. The San Juan Arm, Escalante, you saw a little bit of that, but Gregory Natural Arch would have been underwater. What was your takeaway when you bumped the nose of your boat on the concrete at Huawei?
Yeah, I don't know how you know about that, but of course today that's impossible, but I did take the Tadahatsu right up to the dam and put the nose of it on the concrete.
And nobody minded?
Nobody cared at that time, yeah. You can't even get close to it today, of course. Number one, for safety reasons, this doesn't apply right now because the lake is so low, but they opened up the spillway gates, you'd be sucked into them. But I think they had a buoy line right across the entrances to the spillway gates at that time. But now you can't even get to that point.
Yeah. Right, right.
Larry Testerman, after my trip, and he saw a picture that I took from the inside of the Tadahatsu looking forward to the bow right on the back of Glen Canyon Dam. Larry Testerman and my brother, Greg, who started working at Kitt Peak shortly after I left, actually, they started at Lee's Ferry and rode up to the dam and took the great thumb right up to the base of the dam beyond the signs that were up saying don't go any farther, and bumped it up against the concrete, and a guy by the name of Dick White came running out to tell him to get away and get out of there. So I think Dick White kind of remember, I don't think I ever talked to Dick White, but I know people that knew him, and I think that was kind of a unusual moment when a boater came up and bonked a wooden boat against the bottom of the dam.
Well, especially past the barrier, an upstream travel navigational barrier, they clearly went through that. That would start alerting a lot of people at the dam, hey, wait a minute, there's a boat here. We don't normally see boats here because we got that barrier down there.
Well, there was no physical barrier. There were just signs, and that's true
okay.
today, too.
All right, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. There's no, because today the jetbacks, I mean, the tour boats are coming right up to the left side spillway tunnels, and the ramp that comes down from the road there, coming through the tunnel, the access tunnel.
That does bring up another little thing. We were, Jim Devenny and I and Larry were interested in the river below the dam, so it was not easy to get permission to do this, but we took the boats down through the tunnel, and the Bureau had rules against certain things. We had to make arrangements with the concessionaire to do it. We would not be allowed to take our vehicles or the trailers through. We had to load the dories onto a truck that the concessionaire used to go up and down the tunnel and then launch them. So we did at least two, maybe three trips from the dam to Lee's Ferry.
What year was that?
This would have been in the late 1970s.
Okay.
And then the final one was in the spring of 83, not knowing what was coming. And the launch ramp that used to be there ever since the dam had been finished was washed away during that high water. and was never replaced. But there used to be a way that you could drive right down to the edge of the water.
And that's how you launched your boats in the 70s.
Yeah.
So this would have been on the jet tubes. It would have been just downstream of there as a way to get down to the river?
Well, it would have been just downstream, right, yeah.
Okay.
Because the top of that ramp is more or less right where the jet valves are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to think about how that would have worked. And then all that washed out.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, as you say, they never rebuilt it. So that stopped launching boats there.
That's right.
Okay. Let's talk about that for a minute. I mean, well, how should we do this? Let me back up for a minute. Is there anything else about that 1976 trip that comes to mind?
No, not right now.
Okay. Then, in the timeline, you would have gone back to Tucson, trailering your boat. And what happened next? Did you start working for Hopkins, or how did that go?
Well, 76 is when I stopped working at Kitt Peak. The Lake Powell trip started almost immediately afterwards.
Okay.
I had already done some work. Some pictures had been published by Arizona Highways. And after the 1975 river trip, I thought that I would have, I may not quite remember this correctly, but I had written a story about our 1975 river trip, a very short story. I took it to Arizona Highways. I drove to Phoenix from Tucson and took it into the offices. I knew the editorial people a little bit, and they looked at it and made no comment. And I don't remember who I'm thinking of, but the photo editor or one of the editors looked up from my manuscript and said, "Well, what else are you doing?" So they were not interested. And I said, "Well, kind of floundering around for anything, I'm doing a rowing trip on Lake Powell." And they immediately perked up and said, "Well, we want to hear about that. So let us know when you get back, and we'll give you some guidelines, and maybe something will come of that." And I did write a story for them. This would have been late in 76, and they did not like it. I was working with one particular editor, and he suggested that I read a book about how to write. So it was a particular book, which I did read, and it was called How to Write the Modern Magazine Article.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it had some good information in it, or at least told me that don't do this and don't do that. So I read the book and I said, "Okay, I've kind of got the idea here." And then I remember lying on my couch in Tucson trying to figure out how I can make my story fit the requirements as stated in this book. And I didn't know what to do. I had no idea for several days. They had given me a cutoff date because they were, I believe, about to publish an entire issue on Lake Powell.
Oh, and wow.
This would have gone into that issue, so I didn't have a whole lot of time. And then an idea came to me, the light bulb going off above your head. And it was actually one sentence. And I can't tell you exactly what that sentence was, but it kind of set up the entire rest of the article. So I wrote it. I had a friend who took a look at it, and she thought it was good, and sent it off, and it was used. And it would have been, I think, maybe the May issue of 1977. Maybe a little off on that, too, but Anyway, a story did appear about that rowing trip on the lake. Yeah,
with your photographs.
With photographs, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was the photographs were pretty interesting. I think I don't remember what are the article as seen today would be interesting or not, but anyway, it was the first article I ever had published in a magazine, not the first photograph, but I've gone on to have, I think, maybe 11 or 12 articles published in Arizona Highways, and that was the beginning.
Nice.
I can carry on here, if, okay.
Please.
Okay, so that takes us into 1977.
Okay.
I think I've got the date right, but I was still interested in using the Tadahatsu. So the next idea was to take it up to Green River, Utah and put it in. And once again, alone, float down to the confluence and then row upstream to Moab, or more Ooh. Accurately, Potash. And I did that, I think, in the fall of 77. And the Park Service had told me, this is kind of crazy. Have I discussed this with you before?
No.
Okay. And they were concerned that I would not be able to get back upstream. And I didn't have a permit for Cataract, and I didn't want to go through Cataract alone. So they gave me a like a mimeographed list of escape routes from the river that they had for river runners. So if I got stuck, I could climb out at certain locations. And I had trouble with the trailer as I drove north from Tucson. I noticed, looking in the rearview mirrors, that the tires were not the same distance behind me, left and right. And something had come loose. And I was on the road south or southwest of Kayenta, and I had to find a welder to do some work on the trailer.
So that sounds like the axle had broken loose of the trailer, so the trailer would have been driving sideways down the road.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Not very good. So I had that fixed as quickly as I could. And then I don't remember why, but when I got to Moab, I had to go to a locksmith. And I don't remember what that was about, but it had a connection to my car in some way. And the car had the trailer and the boat on it, and he asked me what was going on. And I told him what I had planned, and he just flat out said, "You're going to die." So that was not very good, to have somebody who knew those rivers, since he lived right next to one of them, tell me that I would soon be dead. But I carried on anyway. Another Park Service person who worked for Canyonlands went with me when I went to when I drove to Green River, and then she drove the car and the trailer back to Moab.
Do you remember her name?
No way.
Okay. Was she? Did she work for Canyonlands?
I believe so. She was a Park Service person.
Did she work in the river unit?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. So let's back up just a little bit. Launching at Green River, Utah, and going to the confluence through Labyrinth and Stillwater Canyons sounds like a lovely journey.
Yes.
Running Cataract Canyon in the fall, when the water's low, not too low, but low, sounds like a lovely journey as well. And yet, you decided you didn't want to run cataract. You wanted to go back upstream to Moab up through Meander Canyon. How did you get that idea?
I didn't know very much about Cataract Canyon, but what I did know suggested that it would be unwise to do it alone.
Okay.
So Cataract Canyon, to me, was just not a good idea. And if I was going to go through Labyrinth and Stillwater, I was going to have to row upstream from the confluence. So
okay.
I don't even think of it as an idea. It was just what needed to be done.
What you're going to have to do.
Right.
Now, were you aware of a rapid on that Meander Canyon section called the Slide?
Yes, yes.
Okay. How did you know about the Slide? Do you remember how you even heard about it?
I don't remember how I heard about it, but I was very aware of it.
Okay.
And one of the things that I took with me was a come-along.
Ah.
Just in case I had trouble at the Slide, which...
Okay.
I don't remember who I talked to, but I don't remember why I knew about the Slide, but I have been told that's where I was going to have trouble, if anywhere.
And this is a place where a large landslide came off the canyon wall, actually made a pretty intense rapid, which over many, many thousands of years, the river pushed all that stuff out of the way. And there's a little funnel that makes a pretty fast jet of water was a upstream block to motor navigation into the early 1900s or late 1800s, because it's a good little jet of water. And I with rowing as an oar boat, I'm like, yeah, I need to come along. I don't know, how am I going to get up this thing?
I didn't have any trouble.
No kidding.
No, it just didn't even... You know, I'm tempted to say didn't even slow down, but of course I slowed it down, but I didn't. You know, it was one shot, rode right through it. And the river was low. It
okay.
was in the fall. It was very low.
Okay.
I didn't know it. No one would have known it, but after I had returned to or gone up to Potash and taken the boat out, I then took it to the Needles District and spent some time in there. And hiked down to the river, and the river was starting to flood. So all of the mud cracks that were so common on my trip on the river were all being covered up by the rising river. So I timed it just right.
So this would have been rising due to some sort of storm activity?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just something at some storm upstream.
Okay.
But
all right, so let's take it from the top. The Green River Launch, there's a couple different places to put in. Did you put in at the state park there, right at the edge of town?
That sounds familiar, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you would have gone under the train tracks and the highway bridge, and then headed down past, what's the name, Crystal Geyser? What's the name of the geyser there?
Yeah, I don't think I know about Crystal Geyser, yeah.
Okay. And then, did you have the Belknap guide with you? Was there any kind of guide to help you along?
I don't remember what maps I had, but I did have maps, and it's
okay.
likely that it was the Belknap guide, yeah.
And how many days did you take for this trip?
It was either six or seven to go downstream, and then either six or seven to go upstream.
Okay.
And I kind of think it was six to go down and seven to go up, even though the upstream section was shorter. And I did quite a bit of hiking. I've only been through that area once since then, and I don't remember the well-known places, so I can't even mention where I hiked.
Well, you might have hiked up to the
Turk's Head.
Turk's Head and the Oxbow.
Right, yes.
Bowknot Bend there.
Yeah.
Maybe the Dennis Julian inscriptions.
Don't know if I saw the inscription. Yeah.
Okay. Fort Bottom, of course, it's easy to see up on the hill there, and the little cabin down below. Yeah.
But so, I was going 20 miles a day through
okay.
there, and boy, there was no one else on the river. I mean, to me, thinking back on it, I'm kind of shocked by that, but I don't remember seeing anyone. And had a great time. You know, the memory that sticks most in my mind is that being alone, I was perfectly silent much of the time, just drifting with the current. And usually, once again, I was at one side of the river channel or the other, partly because the river would tend to be on one side or the other, the outer reaches. So I'm floating along through these beautiful canyons. And then it was like a torpedo was launched from out of the bushes nearby. And it was beavers that were diving into the river. So that always made me jump. And that happened more than once. And one of those beaver ramps coming down into the river, I was looking up into it and saw a bobcat looking down from the other end. You know, I think that may have been the first time I saw a bobcat.
Wow.
And then I got to the confluence, and I'm worried about how this is going to go, but it was no trouble to go upstream, and the slide isn't very far away, and I didn't have any trouble there. And one other thing that came up regarding rowing the dory when I was doing that stretch, and I still think this is fantastic, and it makes me want to have my boat back and do it again. So the river's really low, and sometimes there was so little water in some sections that I couldn't get a good bite with my oars. I was hitting the bottom of the river. It was easier just to get out and pull it along behind me. So it was kind of like the movie without the leeches. I don't think I went very far doing that, but you know, it was a little break from rowing, and it worked pretty well.
Did you work from side to side of the river trying to work the eddies?
Yes.
And ride them back up and then break out into the main current and head over to another eddy on the other side of the river?
I don't remember there being very many eddies at that flow. But I do remember looking up there and saying, okay, I need to cross here pretty soon because it looks a lot better on the right or the left.
And okay.
There was a lot of that. But it was fun. It was really fun. And so here's what I remember that I thought was so great. I'm rowing upstream, and I looked at what was coming a minute or two ago, and there's nothing in the way. I'm just concentrating on rowing efficiently. And then I noticed there's a little bit of difference in the amount of force that I need to put on the oars in order to keep going straight. Things are a little easier on the right side or the left side. And I could feel obstacles in the water because the water was a little more slack on one side, so it was a little easier there than the pulling against the current. I could tell there was a rock just, you know, 20 feet or 10 feet upstream from me. It was just a really cool thing that I could detect that in the oars.
Neat.
Yeah.
And then you would turn and look and make a correction, or would you simply work that easier oar a little bit to bring your nose out a little bit?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly. Huh. I probably turned around and said, okay, well, I'm going to go to the left a little bit and get around that rock.
Okay.
It's too close to the surface. So. So that was just a really cool discovery. And there was a little traffic on that stretch of the river, not very much. And I may only remember one boat, but I saw somebody, which was totally different from the experience over on the green, where there was no one. Yeah.
Did they, I'm assuming they would have come over and said,
no, no connection, yeah.
Didn't stop, didn't say hello, didn't say, what are you doing here?
I don't think so.
Wow.
Anyway, that was a great trip too. And,
Lovely.
you know, having that boat, doing Grand Canyon, doing the lake, doing Labyrinth and Stillwater and Meander, I mean, it was wonderful years. And
Did
I
you
just
run it through Cataract Canyon?
in 1982, so a
Okay.
little later, yeah,
Okay.
we took the three boats, three dories through.
Great. Well, we've been visiting for about an hour. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series. If we do that, is there anything else you want to add about this 1976 hike to Wawi Row in your dory, or the fall 1977 row from Green River, Utah to the Potash Ramp downstream of Moab?
Tom, I've given you everything.
Well, I'm honored to get it, Gary. This is great. Okay, well then with that, this will conclude part five of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Gary Ladd. Today is Tuesday, July 28th, 2022. I'm sorry, it's Tuesday, July 26th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Gary, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.